took the Phoenix Suns 82 games to do what Jim and I, as just a two-man, I guess you can say we're like a tennis couple duo going out there at Wimbledon, winning doubles titles. It took only two of us 25 attempts to get to 25 podcasts. Actually, scratch that. Jim, I think me and you had a few that we ended up messing up the audio on probably or not posting. But point being, episode 25, Phoenix Suns podcast here on Bright Side of the Sun. Jim, we've reached the Phoenix Suns win total. Next week, we'll potentially eclipse the Phoenix Suns overall win total in terms of podcasts. How does that make you feel?
Well, actually, you're going to be eclipsing it in my absence, most likely, because I will not be recording next week. But the week after that, I can still catch up to things as long as you haven't found a permanent replacement that will be exceptionally more well-qualified than I am.
Well, and the other part of that is that there were also some podcasts that I ended up doing solo without you. I think there was one or two that we did interview style-wise where we weren't able to match up with the time, so I ended up doing them solo. So technically, I think we're pretty much close, and part twos and whatnot, we're pretty close to 30 podcasts. Let's not sell ourselves short. We have much more podcast content than the Suns had with overall wins, unfortunately, this year. But that is not the topic of the hour right now. The topic on everybody's mind, NBA Finals is set. We have the Miami Heat. We have the San Antonio Spurs. Before that matchup was made, though, we had a 7-game Eastern Conference Finals. I basically said all season the only team that can push Miami to 6, maybe even 7 games was the Indiana Pacers. They did just that before falling short. Young team got their lumps. Oklahoma City got their lumps from Miami last year, and now the Indiana Pacers get their lumps from Miami this year. What was your big takeaway from the Eastern Finals? What did you think of that series overall, Jim?
I think that the Pacers are an up-and-coming team. I think they're a bad matchup for Miami. I think they're a bad matchup in general for a lot of teams because of their size in the middle. So it wasn't really a surprise to me that they kept that series very competitive. I think I had seen something about the aggregate score going into that Game 7 that was like 459 to 454 in favor of Miami. So it had basically been tooth and nail. And the other thing I think I learned is that Miami is probably in a lot of trouble moving forward, depending on how this situation plays out with Dwayne Wade and Chris Bosh, because LeBron alluded to it in one of his postgame remarks about the Cleveland days, and that team looks a lot like the Cleveland Cavaliers now. It looks a lot like LeBron and not much else. I think one of the games that they won, maybe it was Game 5, Miami's big three was LeBron, Mario Chalmers, and Udonis Haslam. That's the guys that were stepping up behind him. So, you know, hopefully for them, they'll be able to win this year, because I don't think it's looking too promising for Miami in future years.
Yeah, and it's kind of hard for me to verbally articulate this. I might have to go in depth with this maybe on Bright Side sometime. But in 2007, I said that LeBron James, as weird as the sentence is going to sound, that LeBron James is the hardest and the easiest player in NBA history to play with. He's the easiest player to play with because he's an elite superstar that's willing to pass the ball and will pass you the ball every time you're open. But he's hard to play with because you have to learn how to exclusively play off the ball, and you have to learn how to kind of play with LeBron James. So in a sense, it's kind of like Magic Johnson, kind of like Oscar Robertson, but if you insert that Michael Jordan gene of being able to score anytime he wants. So again, it's kind of hard to describe, and it may sound weird hearing that out loud, but you know, go back and look at the San Antonio series, go back and look at all of his years before Miami, look at the times that Miami has struggled. It seems like he's the easiest player in the world to play with. No question the best player in the world. I'm not questioning that at all. But at times it feels like he can be really hard to play with, at least for high level, great caliber players. And going into San Antonio, you're right. I mean, not only the future of Miami, do they have some questions to answer with the way those two are playing and how to kind of formulate the roster over the years, but the NBA Finals pose a really potential nightmare disaster scenario for the Miami Heat. They go into it with the two positions they struggle with against the most, point guard Tony Parker, center Tim Duncan, and then everything in between is good enough to, you know, when they're clicking, match what Miami does with their wings and Chris Bosh. So it'll definitely be really interesting with that series, because I think everything San Antonio does well, you know, plays against Miami. Everything Miami does well, put, you know, kind of plays against what San Antonio doesn't do great. You know, two older teams, so it's not like these are a bunch of young guns going at it. Seven-game series for Miami. It's going to be real interesting. I see this probably going about six or seven games, and I don't know. I see the narrative of Tim Duncan getting his next ring. I feel that genuinely. I'm not just saying that to be the upset guy, but I really do feel that San Antonio is clicking. Tony Parker's the most unassuming superstar probably in NBA history, and Pop is on the Mount Rushmore of coaches when all things are said and done. I see San Antonio winning this in either six or seven. Kind of depends on how games one and two go, in my opinion. How do you see this swinging?
I wouldn't want to lay money on either team because I think it's going to be a really close series. Tony Parker, I think, was the best point guard in the NBA this past season. Not saying that he's the best point guard on an ongoing basis, but for this season, I think he was the best. Tim Duncan, even at his age, he's getting up there a little bit for basketball years, but he's obviously the best big man in the series. The San Antonio role players are better. So if Wade and Bosch are role players, then I think the Spurs can beat the Heat in maybe six if those guys don't show up. If they actually play a little bit better, if Dwayne Wade is 80% of the old Dwayne Wade, if Chris Bosch can go for more than 8 points and four rebounds, then Miami probably wins the series.
That makes sense, right? Yeah, if you can get your all-star caliber players to give you more than what, two shots made, one shot made, like those guys had over the past couple of games, yeah, it definitely does come down to, you know, the great players playing great. You would hope that they can step it up and play great. And, you know, Tony Parker didn't set the world on fire against the Miami Heat this year. He had two games where he scored 15 and 12, respectively, this season against the Miami Heat. Or, pardon me, only 12. He didn't play in the other game. I caught that year wrong. So, you know, his only meeting against Miami was 4 of 14 shooting, 12 points, 8 assists. They lost the game. So, I mean, obviously, different time. You know, that was back in March, and Miami was rolling, and San Antonio was kind of cruising along for the playoffs, and now San Antonio is playing amazing right now. So, yeah, I mean, I wouldn't bet money either way. You're right. I don't bet money regardless on sporting events. But yeah, I mean, with this one in particular, I can see this one going tooth and nail, very similar to the way that the Indiana series went, where it could be very much back and forth, and then kind of climaxing in a game seven or maybe a heated game six for either team. San Antonio, I give a small edge. But that is the global side of things. Like I said, that's what's topical with the NBA Finals being set now. Locally, we got the NBA draft workouts happening for the Phoenix Suns. They had their first group workout, as posted on Bright Side of the Sun. We had that on Monday, where they featured a lot of local flavor with Ryan Evans, who's from out here, and Grant Jarrett, who played college ball in Tucson, as well as a handful of other guys that might be options at 57 with some second-round prospects, some guys that are on the fringe of even being drafted. And the real workouts seem like they're going to begin here tomorrow, or rather I should say today here on Wednesday, with a big workout including Shabazz Muhammad, Rudy Gobert. I know Victor Oladipo's in town, but he might be a Thursday workout guy. But if he's here on Wednesday, that's a really impressive group. But the workouts are starting. They are going to run Wednesday all the way through Monday for sure, with no days off. The only day off this week was Tuesday. So Suns are in effect grinding it out, working on seeing who's going to be the best options at 5, at 30, and at 57, because they do have those three picks. But with the workouts in mind, that kind of brings up, me and Jim were wondering, okay, so we're drafting at 5, we're drafting at 30, we're drafting at 57. Obviously, the history of a pick is not perfect, and it's not like you're going to get that exact same player who's drafted there every year. But let's talk about the history of the number 5 pick a little bit, Jim. It's a pick that has some hits, it has some misses, it's had some superstars. When you look at the number 5 pick overall this year in a weak draft, you know, no one's expecting a superstar to come out of it. But looking at the history of the number 5 pick, who were some of the players that kind of stood out to you, and what were some of the trends that you noticed while looking at the number 5 pick? Let's go ahead and look back at the last 20 years, give or take.
The first thing that struck me when we were going over this was the fact that we really only identified two players that were all-star type of players on a somewhat perennial basis in the last 14 years, with this year being the 14th, I guess. so 13 years. And those two were Kevin Love and Dwayne Wade. Before that, there had been quite a few that did so in the 90s, but there hasn't been a ton of success picking at that position. There have been a lot of starters, so there's a good chance to get a good player there, but it seems like there's a kind of a hard chance to get a great player picking there.
Yeah, and one thing I want to real quick scope, let's look at the one-and-done era, Jim. That's 2007, where Jeff Green was drafted, drafted subsequently by the Boston Celtics and then traded over to Oklahoma City for Ray Allen, another former number five overall pick, and then, you know, back with Boston, obviously, this year. But when you look at the one-and-done era versus looking at the time frame before that where there was guys that can come straight out of high school, you have Thomas Robinson last year, Jonas Valanciunas the year before. We're calling those guys to be determined. We can't say whether or not those guys are great, average, bad, whatever you want to call them. So in that time frame, you're looking at Jeff Green, who's been a quality starter, Ricky Rubio, who's struggled with injuries, who's been a quality starter, DeMarcus Cousins, who's a fringe all-star, but, you know, for other reasons, he hasn't really reached that potential just yet, but he's only in his third year in the league. And then Kevin Love, as we mentioned before, as being the only guy in this group, at least with the one-and-dones, that is, you know, borderline elite-level NBA player, you know, could be a perennial all-star, made the all-star team this past year. When you look at this group and the one-and-done era, do you feel that that's more reflective of what the number five pick is going to be now that there are no high school risks, there are not a lot of, you know, international risks like there were in the years prior to that? Does that feel like more of a synopsis of what the number five pick is to you, or do you feel like the overall 20-year history of it is more reflective of number five?
I think that the newer stuff is. I think, you know, we looked at 20 years back, and obviously scouting and the amount of information that's available is a lot greater. There's a wealth, a fountain of information that is ready now that wasn't in 1992, back when people were still trying to figure out what the internet was to a certain extent. So that changes a lot of the landscape for me. I think that that makes it different. With the other side of that, I think there's less of a chance now to actually hit on a pick in that range or a little bit lower. You know, if Kevin Garnett is a one and done now, a player like that, he's not falling to five because the book's already written on him a little bit more and we have that available information. So I think it diminishes the team's chances to find a diamond in the rough a little bit. That obviously a couple guys are always going to slip through. Lillard last year at six got passed up by some teams that didn't draft nearly as good of a talent, it looks like, at this point. So there is still that chance where teams kind of, you know, a player will kind of drop to a team. But a lot of times coming into these drafts nowadays, you have, like, your consensus 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Like this year, there's a good chance that at least four players we can all name will be in the top five. So there's a little bit less mystery to it. And depending on what the scouting reports kind of say, that's somewhat of a good chance that's what you're stuck with.
Yeah, and it looks like when you look at the overall history, and we'll throw this on the link here so that way everyone can see it. When you look at the overall history of the number five pick, is that there were some, I don't want to say certainties, there were guys that you knew were going to be good, and then there was guys that you knew were going to be a risk factor. Some of the guys that were safe picks ended up not being very good. I mean, Sheldon Williams was a number five pick at one point, and Nikolaj Skidasvili was a number five pick at one point. So there you see the factor of Nikolaj Skidasvili. He could be Dirk Nowitzki. Clearly did not become him. Sheldon Williams, he could be the next, you know, superstar, great defensive player in the post. You know, maybe he'll be, yeah, a Dikembe Mutombo or something like that. It clearly, that wasn't the comparison back there, but you get where I'm going with it. That guy was safe. Sheldon Williams ended up not being a very good player. And then Nikolaj Skidasvili was the risk factor guy, and he ended up not being a very good player. So when you look at the consensus this year, I would say, and you can agree or disagree with me, Jim, the consensus top five in no order, when you look at the likes of, like, Draft Express, ESPN with Chad Ford, self-promotion myself with NBA Draft Insider, the different sites like that, you have Nerlens Noel, Ben McLemore, Otto Porter, Probably Victor Oladipo and Anthony Bennett. I'm just going to say that's probably the consensus five, with Trey Burke as the guy who's consistently lingering around or right around that top five. So when you look at that group, I mean, which player do you feel is the guy that's safe, that you don't think will turn into Sheldon Williams, but then who's the guy who's a risk factor, like Nikolai Shkidisvili, who end up might being a bust and end up might being great? That's probably where you got to look at with the number five pick is, you know, do you take a risk and swing for the fences and try and get a great player, or do you kind of play it safe with the guy that you know what they're going to be, and then there's always that risk factor of them being a bust as well? That's the funny thing about the draft, is there's always a factor of being a bust, and, you know, hindsight always makes people the best scouts in the world, but right now, today, you have to look at who's on the board, and there's a lot of risks in this top five, and there's also some guys who, you know, have the potential of just being a steady, good player.
Absolutely. That top five, for me, if I'm looking at what's the safe pick, what has the highest potential, looking at it like that, is that I think that Noel and McLemore at the top not only have the highest ceilings, but are also the lowest risk to me. So that's a really good combination for those guys, and those are the ones that I have one and two, and a lot of people have them one and two. I think that Oladipo has a lower ceiling, but I don't think he has much bust potential based off of his calling card being defense. Defense and energy would be the second type of thing, is motor. So he's really limited offensively, but I think that he has a low bust potential. Otto Porter scares me because it seems to me like his measurements are his measurables, height, length, you know, wingspan, the standing reach is where people are looking at him as an attractive player. But to me, he seems to lack athleticism. He lacks lateral quickness. He lacks a polished offensive game. So I see him having a hard time adjusting to speeds of the people he's going to be playing against in the NBA. So that's a real red flag for me with him. And Bennett, I don't think he has the potential of those other guys, and I also see a lot of risk there. I didn't get to see his standing reach, some of those things. They weren't listed as measured, but he just seems a little bit undersized, and that can be a pitfall for players there. For me, Bennett, I wouldn't even have in my top five, even though I agree that he's one of, you know, in that consensus group. But I would actually, if it was me and I was at the fifth pick and those other four were gone and I had to pick somebody, I'd take McCollum, because I think that he has more upside, although there's a little bit of risk potential there, more upside than Bennett.
Yeah, Bennett is definitely a risk factor kind of a guy, and that's the conversation that general managers, front offices, that's what they're all talking about, is who's safe. Well, hey, if we take a safe guy, we may not get a great guy. We got to take a risk to maybe get someone who can be great. And I agree with you to the standpoint of, I guess you can say this, when I think of a safe pick, I think of a guy, and this is not an insult. A lot of people take it as, when we talk about players and we say something that's not overly positive about them, that it's negative. So everything Jim's saying is not negative about Anthony Bennett. He's a very good player and a good prospect, and he could be great. And same thing for me with Victor Oladipo, is that I think Victor Oladipo is more of a safe pick, in my opinion, because he's a guy that he may not have the ceiling of other shooting guards that have come out in recent years, but I think that when you can hang your hat on something, he hangs his hat on defense and energy. Two things that it's hard to teach young players that don't have those things. So I think he's more of a safe pick. So like if the top four are gone and Victor Oladipo is sitting there at five, then I would consider him kind of a safe pick. And then you start to formulate what you think the Suns will look like down the road. And you have Goran Dragic still running the point. You have Victor Oladipo 2 years down the road, maybe as the for sure defined starter. You know, Jared Dudley at the three. You start kind of like picturing what the team looks like 2 to 3 years down the road. A draft pick is not made for how good the team is going to be January 28th, 29th, the days after the draft. It's how good are they going to be in 2015. So how good is this player going to be in 2 years with the, you know, the way the team is being built and with the overall way we want this team to look? So that's where I look at when you look at safe, is that Victor Oladipo can hang his hat on defense, no question, and he can hang his hat on energy. He wasn't specifically long, and to go back on your Porter thing without going into too much of a tirade on it, Otto Porter was kind of widely seen as an NBA prospect, a top five guy, if you will, before the NBA draft combine, and his measurables ended up kind of being that cherry on top. It's like, hey, he's you know, really good at what he does, but maybe he's not a great athlete. But then he goes into the combine and measures out as being a guy who's really long, you know, has the physical intangibles to be a really good NBA player. Plus, he has the skill set that he showed at Georgetown. So the explosion, the athleticism, I completely understand that. And those are things that hopefully he can either improve on or work around. But I think that the measurables weren't the reason why he went up. I think the measurables were more of a cherry on top of, hey, this guy's really good. Oh, and he's one of the longest small forwards in this group. He's almost a power forward with his length, but he's able to play on the perimeter. So that's... With the number five pick, was there anything that kind of stood out to you when you looked at the research of guys like, how the heck did that guy go number five? Mine was Tony Batty. I was completely flabbergasted when I looked at 1997 that Tony Batty went that high.
Yeah, that seems like a little bit of a reach on that pick there. If I look at the list, I don't see a ton of picks there that seem like a total reach to me, although... I guess Jonathan Bender kind of sticks out because I have no idea who that is. I know all of their 19 players really well, and I'm guessing that must have been somebody that flamed out of the league fairly quick or was somewhat
notable. You don't know Jonathan Bender? Oh, he was supposed to be the next Kevin Garnett, that really long combo forward that lacks strength, but he's super skilled and athletic. He kind of hung around with Indiana for a while. He was part of that Indiana team during the early 2000s that was, you know, really good fringe NBA Finals caliber team. That's who Jonathan Bender was, is he was that next Kevin Garnett pick. After Dirk was drafted, every international guy that was 6'10 and can shoot was the next Dirk, and after Garnett was drafted, every 6'9", 6'10 guy that had some perimeter skills and was athletic was the next Kevin Garnett. That was Jonathan Bender.
Okay, so now you just dropped some knowledge on me there. I've watched a lot of basketball, but doesn't mean I am up on everybody on here. So that one stuck out to me. That one was pretty salient just by the fact that I wasn't familiar with the name.
Yeah, here's the thing, guys, and the list is on there for you guys to read, but when you look at the number five pick, it should hopefully bring some assurance that, hey, maybe we're not going to get Dwayne Wade or Kevin Love or Ray Allen or Vince Carter, these all-star caliber players, Kevin Garnett, that went number five in the past, but... You know, if you can end up at number five with a player, especially in a quote-unquote weak draft, something I'll never call it, but just throwing it out there because that's what everyone says. But when you look at and you can get a guy like maybe you get a DeMarcus Cousins or Ricky Rubio or maybe you get a Raymond Felton caliber talent or a Devin Harris, you know, Jason Richardson, Mike Miller. You have a lot of guys that went, you know, Isaiah Ryder even for a while was a really good NBA player, but, you know, for other reasons wasn't a great NBA player. You look at that kind of caliber player, maybe not the position of Devin Harris or Raymond Felton because you have your point guard in Goran Dragic, at least, you know, it seems like it. But if you can get a caliber player like that, a guy who's a quality starter that can be maybe top 15 to 25 at their position at number five, then, you know, that's something that you can kind of walk away from this NBA draft and go, we won this NBA draft, despite falling from 4 to 5 in the lottery odds. You win the NBA draft if you leave there with a starter and you're ecstatic and you're, you know, you really won the lottery if you end up with a superstar. So, you know, the team can walk away with a quality caliber starter, which the history of number five says so, then I think that you're winners. And I think that that's something that in 2 to 3 years you determine, not this year.
I also think going into this that this is a good chance for McMiracle to put his stamp on the team, that the hiring obviously was his guy there, but the draft was what he really specialized in, and that was one of the big things that was kind of touted as his main skill set. So it'll be interesting to see how that works and whether, unlike several other years where we had lower picks and weren't able to take the best player on the board and saw multiple better players go later than where the Suns picked, if Ryan can actually take the best player on the board at that time and not have anybody behind him turn out to be a better player or multiple people behind him be a better player. Now, I know that McDonough is into analytics, advanced stats, everything like that, which I don't think McCollum would go that high, but I'm sure that would be a guy he would like based off of some of the stuff he did in college. But besides those five we kind of listed, with Bennett as sort of the fifth person on that quintet there, I know that from what I've talked with you about, that you kind of like somebody else above him. And I was interested to see what you thought in terms of Jafrun's possibilities of drafting a center there and taking a guy like Alex Len or Rudy Gobert.
See, and yeah, and that's something that if you haven't already checked it out on Brightside, there is an article up that I threw out there on the, like we talked about a second ago, it's the NBA draft is not about tomorrow. It's about 2 to 3 years down the road. And when you look at the Phoenix Suns, and one of the things that Jim and I, we went to Marley's, which quiet, somber moment of silence. Dan Marley is no longer with the team. But we went down to Marley's before the season. And Jim, I want to test your memory. Do you remember this conversation that we had where I think you had mentioned it about 40 times in the midst of a conversation where we probably only talked about two or three subjects, but the fact that the Phoenix Suns at the power forward position were one of the weakest teams in the league per 82 game stats in 2011-2012, which, you know, when you're looking at the NBA draft, that's one of the things that I did as well. And it's tough when you look at the Phoenix Suns because they weren't, you know, they weren't a very good team, so they're going to end up being low on the scales at every position. But when you look at them, the two glaring obvious weaknesses for this team were at shooting guard and power forward. But the bad thing about power forward is they're so loaded with players there that they found a way to kind of log jam that position, which is probably why it wasn't super productive. The positions they were really good at, though, were center and point guard. You don't look at point guards because you have Goran Dragic and Kendall already, but with center, you can actually look at that position because the consensus has to be that Marcin Gortat is not going to be on this team much longer than next season. I would actually be a little bit surprised if Gortat made it past the summer into a Suns uniform next year, and I'll be genuinely shocked, flabbergasted, if he's a member of the Phoenix Suns after the All-Star break next year when the trade deadline comes. So the concept of drafting a center comes from the forward thinking, not just thinking about the immediate now. When you look at the 2013 draft that we're in now, there's actually a quality amount of centers, and center is a dying breed in the NBA, but when you get a good one, look at Indiana, look at Memphis, look at San Antonio. All three of those teams were in the Final Four. When you get a really good center, you have a chance to be special and you can create those matchups that Indiana did. And so when you get a guy like Rudy Gobert, who has the potential of being a great NBA defender, or Alex Len, who has some offensive polish and has the athleticism and tools to be a quality all-around player, you get him now, he develops behind Gortat for a year, and then he's able to then maybe take up the center position next year as a full-time starter, and you're not going to be good next year, so you're drafting in the top five again. And that's where, instead of drafting Victor Oladipo or Ben McLemore, obviously, you know, this is the ball's got to bounce your way, but maybe you're drafting Andrew Wiggins. Maybe you're drafting, you know, Jabari Parker. You're drafting a guy that can be that perimeter scorer, that primary perimeter player to help out Goran Dragic. And then you have your center of the future already entrenched in the team for a year, building up strength, because that's huge with centers. They need to build up strength like almost no position because they come in fairly weak into the NBA. That's basically my philosophy on drafting a guy like Gobert or Len. I like both of them. If they went with either of those guys, if the main four are gone and they went with one of those two guys, I think that they'd be in a good position trajectory building forward. If they went with a guy like Anthony Bennett or reached on a guy like McCollum, you're duplicating a position or in some cases adding a third or a fourth wheel to a position that only has so many minutes. So that's my logic behind going with a center. Like I said, I wrote about it. Feel free to jump on there. I don't want to be too long-winded, but Jim, am I crazy?
I'm a stout, I'm a staunch believer in the BPA approach. And that's what I want them to take regardless of position. The center position is one of the hardest to fill. There's like a surfeit of point guards in the NBA right now. So that is one of the deepest positions in the league. So like you said, if you can get a good quality center to anchor your team, then that's obviously an invaluable asset. But like I said, I'm a firm believer in the best player available approach, and I hope that McDonough is also. And regardless of what I think, whether I don't like some of the other players as much, I'd probably be fine with them taking a center at five. Like I said, I like McCollum, so that would be a guy that would be in my thought process. But if he doesn't have much more information available to him and a much better grasp on this right now than I do. I know you scout these guys all year, Chris, so I just kind of dip my toes in the pool for a little bit. But if he doesn't have a much better grasp on what he's doing, where his board is, exactly why he's making all his decisions, where he has these guys ranked, how much film he's watched, how many opinions he's got from within his staff, the scouts, everybody, then it's time to start looking for any GM. So my opinion is fine, and I have my guys that I like, but he needs to take the best player available. We've got holes everywhere. We don't have any great players on this team. So if he thinks there's a great player at one of any five positions, then that's who I want him to take regardless of position.
Yeah, my only thing with that is the point guard position. And like, if you go up at number five and Noel, McLemore, Porter, and Oladipo are gone in whatever order they decide to go in, which I genuinely think that's the top four regardless of how they fall. If you get all those guys off the board and you come up and he genuinely has Michael Carter Williams, CJ McCollum, or Trey Burke, one of those three. Those are all, in all accounts, point guards at the NBA level. If he has one of those guys as top rated available player, but then the next four guys after that are all centers or shooting guards, guys that kind of fill a need, that's the only time where you look at it and go, is best player available the smartest thing to do? But you know, with the point guard position, you draft one, you alienate Kendall Marshall, you know, Deonte Garrett's on his way out the door, maybe regardless, as much as, you know, maybe Suns fans might have liked him or the team might like him, he might be out the door regardless because of just roster purposes. But if you draft a point guard, you alienate Kendall Marshall, you potentially put yourself in a position where Goran's got to slide over more to the two than being the one, and you kind of, you know, signed him to be your point guard of the future. So the only position is point guard where best player available might hurt the Suns, but with this team, I've said it on numerous occasions, they need talent. And if it ends up being a point guard, I'm not going to criticize Ryan McDonough unless it blows up in their face, which we won't know for 2 to 3 years. So point guard, best player available, that's tough sell to the franchise, to the organization, to the fans and all that. That's going to be the tough selling point.
Right. I agree with you in terms of that. But I also agree that if he does make a selection like that, then I'm handing him the rope, and we'll see how it works out, whether he has success with that pick or whether it's just enough rope to hang himself. So with some of those players, though, like if you're going with Burke, who's 6'1", not necessarily as athletic as McLemore, Oladipo, some of these guys that actually have those great physical abilities, the athleticism, a guy like that isn't even a combo guard at all. So now you've got somebody that can only play one position, and not only that, but he's probably a defensive liability most nights. Whereas it's a little bit different with a guy like McCollum, who's more of a combo guard that can go between the two positions. So, you know, a little bit different types of situations with a couple of those picks.
Yeah, and same with Michael Carter Williams, who measures out as almost 6'6" in shoes. So, you know, like you said, circumstances are different with those three guys when you consider that Burke is basically the exact size of Chris Paul, maybe a touch longer, a touch taller.
Right. So, you know, if that's what's there, then he can do what he wants. And hopefully he's also working on other avenues to move up, acquire more picks, whatever he thinks is prudent with that. Because I'll tell you, with any of those guys, that my three, like I said, is Noel, McLemore, Oladipo, and after that, I am not nearly as sure about the prospects of anybody else being as much of a safe pick, where I really feel that there's very low potential of this not turning out well.
Yeah, and I agree. I throw Porter in there over a guy like Oladipo. I don't see Oladipo's ceiling as being as high as other guys. And again, people are going to take that as, you know, hater comments or whatever the people are saying nowadays. But with a guy like Oladipo, I'm probably the lowest on him of everybody, but I definitely think he's a top 10 talent. I think he's really good, and he's going to be a quality NBA player. But you're right. I mean, but here's the thing, is that Ryan McDonough's board, just as, again, fans need to understand, the NBA draft is 2 years down the road and projecting what these guys are going to be. So, you know, whoever they go with, as long as it projects down the road and it makes sense, as long as it kind of fits into the puzzle a little bit with the 2014 draft, as long as it fits within the puzzle of free agency. That's where all this has to line up. So on the surface, someone may hate or love the pick, but at the end of the day, it's going to come down to how well does this fit into the overall puzzle, which right now we're barely putting the sides together. I don't even know if we got all four corners, but we're starting to put the sides together, and this puzzle, the Phoenix Suns' future, is got a whole lot of spaces that need to get filled out, and this NBA draft is just one of those pieces. This is not the only piece. You don't got to get a superstar at 5, and we didn't get a chance to talk about it here at 30, which we'll go into more in-depth with that here either next week or in the coming weeks, but that's a lot of number 5 pick talk. We had the round table on Monday. We got the podcast today. And I'm sure that's all the fans are talking about. So a whole lot of conversation about this number 5 pick. And it seems like it can go in one of numerous directions based on whichever expert you're deciding to read.
And I know that you'll get roasted for any kind of criticism of Oladipo that doesn't have him right at the top of the draft.
Yep.
Among the listeners to this podcast, because there's a huge love affair between Suns fans and Oladipo right now, it seems.
Yeah, they're definitely. It kind of feels like if the Suns don't get Ben McLemore or Victor Oladipo, that they may pitchforks and riot U.S. Airways Center. But there's a very, very, very strong chance, because those are, in all intents and purposes, from the NBA people I've talked to and from, you know, the agents and different things like that, it, for all intents and purposes, the four best players in the eyes of the NBA guys are Noel, Porter, McLemore, Oladipo, and wouldn't shock me if all four of those guys are the first names called, you know, in late June here for the NBA draft, and the Suns are standing there with the conversation of which of the 10 guys that we have basically rated at the next level do we want to take. I mean, they really could go through a bevy of different options at number 5 with all four of those off the board.
And even if Oladipo does fall to 5, because I think he's the most likely out of that group to fall to 5, if McDonough picks somebody else, they announce a different pick, and Oladipo isn't the selection, then I really don't mind that at this point either. It's not going to break my heart, because like you said, it's about a couple years down the road. And at the same time, after Oladipo, after the 5th pick, I would still say that there is an excellent chance that somebody down on that board further ends up reaching a higher potential than Oladipo, because I don't think he has the greatest ceiling. So I think that there's a very good chance that somebody below him is going to end up being a better player.
Yeah, well, the higher you go in the draft, the more chances there are for someone to be better than you, because if you go number 1, then you get 59 other guys plus the undrafteds to be better than you. And, you know, that happens. So, like, the later you go in the draft, the better chance you have to overexceed your expectation and be better than people ahead of you. So, you know, whoever the Suns take at number 5, there's a chance that there's a Kenneth Faried at number 20 that ends up being one of the top 3 to 5 players in that entire class. And people look back. Again, hindsight makes everybody the best scouts in the world. So we'll be able to pick this pick apart and criticize it for years to come and see whether or not the Suns landed a viable starter, a bust, or one of the few guys that actually turned out and panned out to be perennial all-stars when you look at number 5 picks overall. So that's going to do it for us. Jim, you always find a way to eloquently and wisely give us some sage advice, some wisdom, ending the podcast. What do you have for us today?
We were just talking about the hindsight being 2020, when you can look back at the draft a couple years down the line and figure out who those talents are. So what McDonough needs to do is engage in some really advanced statistics, some really advanced metrics, and actually go forward in time a couple years, so that way when he comes back, he can already have the hindsight headed into this year's draft. So that's what needs to happen.
You put pressure and potentially unbelievable expectations. I think only Christopher Nolan can make that happen. So we'll get Ryan on the phone with Christopher Nolan. We'll get some intense sound effects, and we'll make this happen. That's the podcast, 25 episodes in. Hopefully we're just this strong 25 more episodes down the road when the Phoenix Suns are starting up next season, probably. Talk to you guys next week.